A Taste of Ireland with Ireland's Blue Book. A romantic collection of Irish country house hotels, manor houses, castles and restaurants. Ireland'sBlueBook.com.
On Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
Hi, this is Ed Finn. Good to have you joining me this Sunday evening, the 7th of March. Tonight we're looking at some of the best of A Taste of Ireland, and we begin with well-known celebrity chef Paul Flynn, who discusses some of his many cookery books.
Yep, Jamie Oliver's quaking at his, in his boots. Yes, I have.
An Irish Adventure with Food. Second, Helpings, which I thought was brilliant. Your third book, Surf and Turf, you wrote with some fella from Cork. Can't remember his name. What was he?
No idea. Mary something. I don't
know. Yeah. Martin Shannon, that great fishy, of course. And you also wrote a very good instructive book, I think, in collaboration with Lidl as well. Yeah. Tell me, do you love writing, do you?
I do. I used to be the Irish Times food writer going back 15 years ago. And I was just, I love talking, actually. I never realised I love talking, but I'm pretty good at it, as it turns out. But everybody needs a break. And I think at the time, well, I know at the time, is that we were 2 years into the tannery, or 3 years, something like that. But we used to have really great summers, but the winters were always hard. Seasonality was always a problem. So therefore, getting our name out was a really important thing. Now, you can place ads, but ads cost money. And also, they tend to sit amongst other ads, and everybody knows you paid for them. So when people write about you, or you have another platform, it became apparent very early that I had to, for survival, you know, for us to survive, I have to think outside the box. So good fortune can play a part. And the editor of the Irish Times magazine, there wasn't even a magazine at the time, her child was in Ring, Patsy Murphy, and she got talking to me, and we just had a big chat and bonded and got on instantly. She said, would you write a piece for the Irish Times? And I said, on what? I can't write, I can't type, I can't do anything, and you know, I have no qualifications. And I was more bothered than positive about it, let's put it that way. But she said, just have a go. Anyway, so I had a go. Two or three times I wrote articles about just, and I really wanted to describe to people what life was like in the country and how we lived and how we regarded food and what our friends were like. And I was really honest about it because it tended to be a bit all too Dublin. And, you know, there's more to Ireland than Dublin, that's for sure.
Of course. Well, coming from Cork, I can agree with that.
No, we won't even go there. I won't even give you a platform. And but I started writing and I really enjoyed it. And I used to write longhand. Maura used to go in, grab it, take a couple of plates up to the customers and start typing, you know, transcribing what I wrote. Anyway, it went on well. And she asked me to be the food writer for the forthcoming magazine. So I was the food writer for maybe 3.5, nearly 4 years. And that was great. And that gave us that platform. It really did. And what happens that I've learned subsequently is from that, my first book came, there was a book offer, and from that, my first TV series. And so if you're a little shy person in the bush, if you're a business person, you cannot afford to be that. And I'm not necessarily, even though I said I love talking, speaking in front of people isn't my thing. So yeah, really tentatively, I had to learn new skills, I suppose, and bring myself out of myself. And you kind of have to, because you just want to keep the jobs. You want to keep your job. There's a mortgage to be paid. You want to keep everybody else employed. That's the thing. So therefore, you just push yourself out. But from that, various things happen. So, you know, after I became the food writer, and that went by the wayside for maybe 12 years or so, they asked me to be the food writer again. So I have been for the last year. And I type with one finger on my iPhone as fast as I can. And at least I'm self-contained now. I don't have to get Maura to do it for me. Well, I still email it to her and she corrects my punctuation, which apparently is really bad. So I'm delighted. Again, it's still about a new platform and it's another side of me. And I love that. I love the fact that I can sort of, you know, express my feelings and my silly ideas, because I tend to try and be a little bit quirky and really be allowed to be myself, which is an important thing as well.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting, because I remember interviewing George R.R. Martin, the writer of
Game of Thrones a couple of years ago, and he was telling me about his process, you know, and he had a computer and he wasn't connected to the internet, and you know, he was away from everything, and he used an old TriStar program that was hundreds of years old, you know. Yeah. But did you have that same thing? You were saying you do it on your phone, so you didn't have your little routines that you had to have, you know, at the end of your book, you lit your cigarette or you had your glass of champagne.
Go for a pint. When you could go for a pint. No, not at all. I'm deliberately not connected to any process, only because I'm useless at technology. That would be the basis of my caveman-esque approach to writing. And I can't use a keyboard. So I just do it. But thankfully, I don't have to write any autobiographies or anything. They're all short.
Writing, I think you'll agree, for people, I suppose, that don't do it, and I do a bit of travel writing as well, it is an amazing sense when you do finish something, and sometimes you look back and you think to yourself, God, did I write that? When I read your stuff, you can actually taste the food. You have a great gift in that respect, and I think, so, I mean, were you delighted with your first book? I mean, that thrill of, you know, holding it in your hand.
It was amazing. Yeah, it was amazing. To have it, you have it forevermore. And actually, I don't even have a copy of the original one. I gave them all away. I think there's just a sense of achievement with it, that somebody has had confidence in you to print. They believe you'll sell, and that's a really good thing. Now, it didn't happen massively, I'll have to tell you. But it still is a lovely thing to have. And books do lead on to other things, they really do.
And leading on from there, so, I mean, very interesting how it's a great way, I suppose, keeping the tannery in people's minds and eyes. And then, of course, you went on, I mean, you know, won Lords and Ladles and, you know, all your... I mean, you did so many great TV programmes, and I suppose TV, of course, being a great medium for food and cookery.
It is, and I have my own comfortable place when it comes to TV. Not that I've done a bit. I haven't done loads, and it's not my first job, because, you know, one day the phone won't ring, and that's a reality. So you have to put it in a place where one day you'll be disappointed, and you have to get on with your life and all that. But more than anything else, I really enjoy it. I'm not brilliant at piece the cameras, you know, when you're telling people, you know, how recipes work and all that. There are other people that are amazing, like Rory O'Connell is gifted. I look at him and I go, why can't I be him? But I love being out and about with other people. I particularly love interacting with other chefs, Lords and Ladles. You know, Derry and Catherine are brilliant, and the team that are, and just being kind of thrust into this environment where you have to cook, understand it, make it edible, which is always important, particularly with Lords and Ladles, because some stuff, the recipes were challenging, to say the least. But it's an experience. It really is a lovely, I used to always just love getting into the car. So you'd have 3 days blocked off, work would be all boxed off, let's put it that way, because you wouldn't be leaving otherwise. And thanks to my head chef and Maura and Daniel and everybody else who runs the place when I'm not there, and you just go off and it's an adventure, and I love it.
You have to blank out everything else and just focus, laser focus, really.
Yeah, and it can be really a bit weird, and sorry, this is a bit name droppy and I apologise, but I never think of myself as anything more than somebody who was in a kitchen, a chef just working to make nice food for people all the time. But we were in New York, and friends of mine, we were watching Codaline.
Oh yeah.
And then the two, and they were young. Normally I get older ladies shuffling up to me. But these are young couple, they were just saying, are you, anyway, they couldn't believe that I was standing there, but they were fans of Lords and Ladles. And for a long time I was on Netflix, and I was in USA, it was in Canada, it was in Australia, New Zealand, all that kind of stuff. So I was more embarrassed than they were, to be honest with you, but I couldn't believe it was happening and getting recognised at a Codaline concert.
I thought you were going to say it was from Moran Dahi or something like
that. No, don't mind that fella.
I saw you trying to teach Dahi a few things and tricks over the years, but I wonder, did it work?
No, it's pointless. Now, he has got an understanding of food. Sometimes he amazes me. I mean, it's slowly sinking in. He's by no means stupid, as you well know. But look, we work together, because we do a lot of ploughing together. Dahi would be there all day, every
up
day.
In the back of the tractor.
Worker. He'd be up in the back of anything. You wouldn't know. But
I love it.
We had the crack.
Brilliant. Come here. You decided then, of course, another progression, which was really interesting. You then opened your rooms. You became a place to stay. Townhouse.
What happened was that, I mean, all due to our effort, myself and Maura, is just we wanted to be a really good restaurant. And again, I said at the start, not just for the locals, but, you know, we wanted people to travel to us. And they started doing that, and they were looking for a place to stay. So the natural progression from that was to put on rooms, and we have 14 rooms now and a cookery school.
And the cookery school is fantastic. Again, I know a few people that have gone to it and they were telling me even basic stuff like cutting onions and things like that that a lot of people struggle with, like me included. They came away very pleased with themselves.
Good. Well, that's good. I mean, the thing is that I learned pretty quickly that it's now not about showing people that you can cook. It's about showing them how to cook. So you start off simply. And there is different, as with any class and any teacher, is that you don't assume, I don't assume that people know loads. And just to find that middle ground that everybody's happy with. So hopefully I try and I enjoy teaching and I enjoy, but I don't do it in a very serious way. You know, I tend to go off piste an awful lot and I look at people's faces and I go, oh my God, have I gone too far? In terms of showing people that cooking is very much, you know, about adding, for me, adding a little bit of this and a little bit of that until you get something that tastes nice. And it's not something to be scared of. Black is usually, unless it's a truffle, is the colour to be avoided, and smoke and bad smells. But aside from that, it can be, if you take your time and, you know, love the process. And there are lots of people out there who love cooking for the sake of it, me included. And that doesn't include cooking for your children when they're about to arrive home from school, starving with the hunger. That's a different thing altogether.
And Paul, what's really is you're a member, of course, of Ireland's Blue Book. Yeah. What does it mean for the tannery to be part of the Blue Book?
Well, a lot. It means a lot. And it's sort of, when they asked us, we weren't sure that we would be ready for it, because I mean the whole thing about Blue Book going back is that they've big beautiful houses, big beautiful rooms, and you know, stately homes in many cases, and long admired and long cherished businesses that have been there for generations in many cases. And then, you know, we're a townhouse, so by its nature, you know, the rooms aren't as big, but we have a great reputation for food that we uphold and try to uphold all the time. So we're really privileged to be part of it. And, you know, Ross, there are other restaurants there, Ross Lewis and Derry at Leckervan and Chapter One are there as well, and lots more in Giebel's.
Yeah, and Campania down in Kilkenny. Great spot,
we're
Gareth Byrne.
We're honoured to be part of it, really are.
It seems to be a terrific network of support as well for everybody. That's what I get when I talk to different people who are the members there.
It really is.
That brings us nicely on, Paul, to your second choice of music this evening, Paul, Kyoto.
Phoebe Bridgers is this amazing lady that lives in Brooklyn, and I will credit Spotify Radio for uncovering her for me. And what it is that, you know, I never wanted to be the guy that listens to the Eagles until he dies, you know, and I love the Eagles, I love 1970s music, all that. The radio setting just churns up music like that artist, and I'm a massive fan of The National. They're my number one band. And they have worked together, Phoebe Bridgers and The National. She sometimes has sung with them. But anyway, in her own right, she is a massive, massively talented artist. And I love, it's from her new album. And it soothes me as I cook it at home on a Sunday evening. And I want to bring her to everybody. I'm kind of championing her.
A Taste of Ireland with Ireland's Blue Book. A romantic collection of Irish country house hotels, manor houses, castles and restaurants. Ireland'sBlueBook.com
on Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
Welcome back. You're listening to the best of A Taste of Ireland. Next up this evening is Michelin star chef Ross Lewis, who tells me what it means to him to be part of Ireland's prestigious Blue Book.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, as you can never stand still, and you just have to keep pushing. As you know, Dublin is a very competitive restaurant market now, and it's very hot. And so for us, the Blue Book was, firstly, I think it was a great brand association. You know, they're a great brand, the Blue Book. At their heart is quality. Very often kind of owner-operated hotels in very unique places in Ireland. And they decided to take on some restaurants. And I think we were the first batch of restaurants to go in. I think it was, they didn't operate in Dublin. There were no hotels in Dublin because there were Irish Country House Association, you know, Country House. And so they took Patrick Gilbo's, us and Leckervan, and I just thought it was a great brand association. There's a lot of people come to the country to visit Blue Book properties. They thought, and rightly so, well, sure, we have no restaurants, so, and they're not competing with the hotels, so why don't we put them in? So they did that, and they've added some more since. But yeah, and look, we get a lot of business. They have a very big voucher business, and people buy vouchers and they use them in Chapter One, get some press from it. And just it, for us at that particular particular point, I thought it was a really big help for us building our particular brand, you know.
I know you don't like to be described as a celebrity, Chef Ross, but you have cooked for lots of celebrities. Now, I suppose one of the most famous of them would be the Queen herself.
The Queen herself, yeah.
HRH. Yeah, and yeah. What, I mean, I know she was very fond of Cork people, right? Because we all saw her visit to the English market,
right,
when she was smiling her head off, and it was a fabulous picture. But what was that like, Ross? Was that serious pressure?
Yeah, it was unbelievable. I mean, you know, visit of the first reigning monarch since Queen Victoria, and obviously the history between Ireland and England, going back down the years, and, you know, to be chosen to cook the banquet dinner for 170 people, you know, was a huge honour. But with huge honour comes massive responsibility. And, you know, failure was not an option. And so I was dealing with three different departments. There was the Oras Department of Taoiseach and Foreign Affairs. And so there was a lot of batting around. And, you know, I put together a patchwork quilt menu from all over Ireland, really, to try to represent some of the great indigenous handcrafted produce that we do make. And we have some of the best produce in the world. But it was 170 people, and I think it was an hour and 10 was the time we were given for four courses. Now, you know, you mightn't have to know a lot about catering, but to deliver a meal an hour and 10 for 170 people is just unbelievable. And so, look, we set about doing it. There was an awful lot of preparation, and yeah, it was very nervy. But look, you know, we worked really, really hard, and after it was like coming out of the trenches of war, and it was really anticlimactic, the feeling. I thought we'd be like all, you know, high-fiving each other, and we were just so drained and exhausted. But I kind of remember, you know, having a couple of beers and going home, and I got up the next morning, and the president called me, Mary McAleese, and she basically, you know, she just said, "I want to thank you so much for last night." And she went on for about 2 minutes, and, you know, it's seldom in my life I've had the kind of praise she gave me, and I thought that was incredible, and what a great touch from a woman who had the common touch. And, you know, this, she spent three, four minutes on the phone to me, you know, while the Queen was still, you know, resident here in Ireland. And so it was amazing, amazing honour. It was amazing accolade. I suppose it's a bit like getting a cap for Ireland. They can never take it away from you. But I'll never get away from it.
Well,
the other fellow cooked for the Queen. That's going to fall. I think it'll be on my epitaph. Here lies Ross Lewis. He cooked for the Queen.
Must be one of the most incredible things. I mean, I know, certainly when she went to Cork that time, I remember seeing her in the market. And I mean, I know they're still dining out and will be for a long time on that, because, I mean, she is so iconic and, I mean, an institution in herself. Mm. So that must have been amazing. Over the years, Ross, I mean, I know you've had loads of celebrities as well. I mean, that have come in. They love your place. I don't want you to name names or anything, right? But have you had weird and wonderful requests, or are they usually fairly easygoing?
No, they're fairly easygoing, yeah. I mean, we had Barbara Streisand booked the restaurant after her concert, and she was really, really late, and they didn't get there until about 2 o'clock. But they were great, and, you know, the dog was eating the steak off the saucer with the diamond necklace and the whole lot. And so, you know, you get all these kind of things. And, you know, we've had Al Pacino in a couple of times and so on and so forth. But very many over the years, and some very many kind of other famous people, you know, politicians and writers and artists and so on and so forth. And it just makes it very interesting. It's a richly embroidered business. And you're getting great customers like that. You know, and Seinfeld was in, and, you know, people like that. So Seinfeld came into the kitchen and he said to me, I have a lovely painting out in the front room. It's called End of the Night by an artist called Manuel Cosio. And it's very striking. He's a hyper-realist, and it kind of comes off the wall. And he was chatting to me in the kitchen, and he said, what's with the painting? I said, well, it's, you know, this artist. And he says, is it for sale? And I looked him straight in the eye, says, Seinfeld, it's not, you can't afford it. And he looked back at me and he said, you think?
Oh,
wow. Another man with an amazing career, reinventing himself regularly. That's amazing. That's a fabulous story.
Yeah.
I suppose, Ross, we can't have a nice chat without talking about COVID-19, which I guess is every restaurateur's nightmare to a certain extent. But I was chatting to a few people the other day and they were saying to me that they'd actually booked one of your chef table, one of your very fancy, one of your really lovely menus that you do there. And of course, the decor is amazing. I think it's on this, you've done a lot of work on the kitchen, decor and stuff. Yeah. But they were saying that they're now going to enjoy themselves by treating themselves to really good dining experiences in Ireland, right?
Yeah,
and they're living near in Dublin. So, I mean, I suppose in terms of size and reduced capacity, how are you finding it at the moment? That would be a slight positive, I guess. How are things going?
Yeah, I mean, there's been great reaction. Just as I said, I've met a lot of people like that who are saying, you know, look, we're here and we're happy to eat out and, you know, spend a bit of money on you know, premium dining experience. And, you know, they've been in great form and really, you know, kind of they're consuming and they're happy and, you know, they're loving it. And it's been... We've had a, you know, look, I've been 27 years in Chapter One, so we've been curating a very large custom base, you know. So, you know, look, these things stand to you greatly when you go into these kind of situations. I mean, no one could have ever expected what has happened. It's you know, so unprecedented, it's unfathomable, but very confusing for our industry. I found that the affirmation we've got from good customers that have been back in and thrilled to be there and so happy to support you has a memory that I'll take with me for the rest of my life. Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, and of course, I'm sure with the American market, it would have been a big one, especially for the hotels around Dublin. But, you know, it seems to me that I think a lot of people are, and hopefully it'll continue, is that are now enjoying treating themselves to to fine dining experiences. Your Chapter One, where better than that? Finally, Ross, these are questions I know you're probably going to hate, right? Because chefs hate these questions, about, you know, what's your favourite food and all that. But what are your pet hates when it comes to service and what foods don't you like?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose there's two extremes. Most people, I think, you know, like myself, I don't like an overly fussy service because, you know, people flummoxing around you. But I think, you know, that's trumped by really poor service. you know, the wait staff that you just can't catch his or her eye.
Yeah,
because they're, you know,
nobody puts baby in the corner can be the worst. Ignoring people can be
top, will you? And you go into a restaurant and there's some manager fella at the till and he never, you know, acknowledges you. And there's some wait staff who you just can't track. You can't even get a drink to start and so on and so forth. And so that kind of, that kind of new form of service. It's not some of my favorite foods. I hate those, you know, the gambas, the very cheap ones that come from Thailand.
Those that eat all the rubbish at the bottom of the sea.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, chicken manure and all that kind of thing. And then they're shipped over here and they're everywhere. And you know what I really hate? Because I was in a restaurant, I won't name names, obviously. And it was I was supposed to be getting deep fried Dublin Bay prawns. And, you know, and it was a restaurant near the sea. And I thought, I'll have that because, you know, you got to get it. And I came out with those and my heart sank. But sure, you get worse knocks in life, Edward.
Yeah, but you couldn't pull the wool over your eyes when it comes to that. Right. He was barking up the wrong tree there, I'll tell you. What is your restaurant you really like to go to?
Yeah, so I give you my favorite restaurant in the world is a place called Trogro down in Roanne. It's outside Lyon. It's now in the third generation of the family. It's had three Michelin stars for 52 or 3 years. They recently moved to outside Roanne, which is a kind of an industrial village near Lyon, to a green space. And they bought a farm and they put a restaurant there. And the design narrative is off the charts. And he cooks a French style of food, but with a kind of a Japanese approach, really simple, really clean, really light, really elegant. And if you ever want to go somewhere and see what the very, very top end is like, it has everything. It just is so special. And, you know, I've been there several times, to the new place twice, but I was in their other place some three or four times as well. I took some of my core management there this year, and from the time you pull up in the car park and you're looking at how the car park is even designed with all these trailing plants and wooden trellises, and you walk through them and up into this very imposing old building, and then they've put a glass box on the outside of a restaurant, and it's in a wild garden and a kind of part farm. It's just incredible.
What would Ross Lewis's guilty pleasure be? If I open your fridge at home now, or if I called in, what would be in the fridge? Or what do you like to have that wouldn't be so Michelin, maybe?
Yeah. I'm partial to the odd drop of ketchup now, I'd have to say that.
I wouldn't be afraid of my life to ask for ketchup in your place now.
Ketchup on my spaghetti.
Like, did you hear what your man asked for outside? God.
I'm a plain sort of fella, you know, cheese on toast, smothered in ketchup or HB sauce would do me.
Very good. So, yeah, no, I heard you previously talking about, I think you're partial to a tuna sandwich as well, are you?
Yeah. Tuna melt.
Yeah, like I must that, say, yeah. I like that yeah, as well yeah. myself. Very good. Finally, Ross, before I get your last piece of music, and it's been a pleasure to talk to you this evening, as a fellow Corkonian, I have to ask you, tripe or drisheen?
Oh, Jesus, it's definitely tripe. Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. I'm not a big fan of the drisheen, actually. Yeah.
I think I'm with you on that one, Ross. Yeah, brilliant. Yeah. So tell us, what have you chosen as your final music choice this evening?
So this is a band, Prefab Sprout. And I remember my memories of this are when I worked in Manhattan and they were kind of coming to the fore, and it's kind of early in mid-80s. And there was great emphasis in the bar at night time. There was a bit of a vibe going on the jukebox. There was a couple of Irish and English working there, so we used to make sure the jukebox was filled with like quality gear, as they'd say. So and Prefab Sprout had two or three on that. So I remember always listening to it, and I think Paddy McAloon is a genius. And they recorded everything with Thomas Dolby, and the sound is amazing.
Wonderful. Ross Lewis, thank you so much for joining me this evening.
Sunshine 106.8.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Best of A Taste of Ireland. Finally this evening, celebrity chef Kevin Dundon talks about his love for the food industry.
Yeah, I guess from a very early age, my whole family are mad into food. So mum in particular, my grandparents. And basically, when we were sitting down for dinner tonight, we'd be talking about what we're going to be having for dinner tomorrow night. And mum was actually brought up in Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, from the age of 3 till she was 18. So she had kind of an unusual palate for us here in Ireland. So we were actually eating more interesting food than the majority, where it was very much meat and two veg. But we were eating all sorts of, well, they're probably not unusual now, but we were eating lasagnas back then.
Yeah.
Like, I'm 54, so you can go back, you can work it out. But we were eating babuti, which is a lovely minced curry with grated apples with an egg topping baked in the oven. It's an amazing dish. But we were eating peri-peri chicken, but stuff that you would eat now, which would be just the norm. But back then, it was quite interesting.
For me, that's hilarious because I lived in Cape Town for 7 years.
Oh, well, then you know babuti.
So babuti and milk tarts and, ostrich. I mean, these were all amazing stuff. But that was one of the most delicious things. I used to love that. It was delicious.
It's a real comfort food. It's like our cottage pie.
Yeah.
Real comfort food. But my very first experience of cooking was when I was about 7. And Dad and we were in Kilkee in County Clare. And we used to go down there every summer. And Dad and myself went out fishing and we caught a heap of mackerel. I just remember it was one of those days you put the rod in, six mackerel came up, and we'd two boxes. So I was selling the mackerel on the side of the pier when we came in off the boat. And we went back and then mum cooked them, and she literally just grilled them with a little bit of lemon butter on top, lovely potatoes and green beans. And they were fantastic. And then the next morning, my grandparents were staying. The next morning, I got up and I decided I'd cook them breakfast in bed. So I put the mackerel under the grill. I was way ahead of my time because I put the mackerel under the grill and just barely seared them. So there was seared sashimi. They were basically raw, right? So I put them on a plate. I gave them cold toast and cold tea. brought it into them in their bed, and they sat up and ate the whole thing.
Was it an early ceviche? Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, a budding master chef.
Budding master chef. Way ahead of my times.
The old schoolhouse, I suppose, when it started, I mean, your career, that would have been was a really cool place to go. I mean, yeah. I remember the food was fabulous.
But basically what happened was I went to college in Dublin, so I went to Dublin DIT, and then my job placement was in the old schoolhouse for a year, and then I was in Air Square, and I was in a restaurant called Coffer's Restaurant in Cope Street, just behind Bloom's Hotel, or the old Jury's, and with a chef called Jack Hart. He was a really good chef, and I worked with Patsy McGuirk as well in Dublin, and then I got a scholarship to go to Switzerland, so through CERT, which is no longer, it was an apprenticeship board here in Ireland, now Fáilte Ireland.
Yeah, that was a great scheme.
It was a fantastic scheme, and it produced brilliant chefs. And we had a consistent flow of chefs coming through the system, which we're sadly lacking now. But I think they're talking about bringing that, something similar back into the system, which would be fantastic to bring more apprenticeships through our amazing industry. I worked in a restaurant called Mer Catherine in Zurich, and the chef there. What I really got about the Swiss is they're very organized people, and they're very, like, their kitchens are spotless, and there's a place for everything. And I think there was a great learning to be had there, which means then if you walk into our kitchens in Dunbrody, everything's got a place, and it's, and the place is spotless. And I'm only happy if I'm working in a clean environment, and which is great because I'm a chef and it should be clean anyways. But it was a very interesting. Place to work, because what happened was is that I got the scholarship, your name goes into this hat, and then the restaurant will actually pull you down from this group of candidates, and I ended up going to the Caribbean in between college and Switzerland, and I worked for Windstar Sales, which is the largest sailing yacht in the world, 150 passengers, and I was on that for about 6 months. We took it out from Le Havre, went across to the Caribbean, and then my visa was coming through for Switzerland, so I left the boat and lived in Miami for about 6 weeks waiting on my visa. So I was like, and what actually happened, do you remember the user cards? They did a mistake on my card saying I was 23. No, it wasn't. I didn't do anything. They actually made the mistake, but it worked to my benefits because I was actually only 18 or 19, which meant that I could actually go into the bars in Miami. So I had a great time in Miami for 6 weeks, and then came to conservative Switzerland. And I always, you know that song, "Stop Talking Heads, Stop Making Sense"? I always remember that song, walking around Zurich Sea, which is the lake in Zurich, saying, what am I doing here? It was like a prison sentence, because you'd walk into a bar, and I had no German. You walk into the bar and you'd ask the person beside you, do you speak English? And they'd say, yes. And then that would be the end of the conversation.
That so was the English.
After about 3 months, I could speak German, and I ended up getting great mates, and I actually enjoyed the year. But the first 3 months was hell.
Yeah, and of course, Zurich today, I mean, it's actually, I mean, our own James Joyce, of course, is buried there in the beautiful Fluntern Cemetery. I've been there to visit. And it's a real bohemian city now. I mean, it's really changed a lot.
My very first day working in the restaurant, I broke the tip of my finger and the top of the freezer. I was asked for a sorbet, and the freezer lid, I threw it up and I put my hand in, and the lid came down and crushed my fingers. So I was actually off work for 3 weeks or something like that. But they had sick police, and they used to come, like, you had to be in your room at 10 o'clock at night time, and they came and checked. They did actually come and check to make sure you were there.
Wow.
It was crazy.
Early tracing.
But the best thing was this lady of the house, and she used to drive me mad and come in at 8 o'clock in the morning. So what I did is I set my alarm clock one morning for 7:45, and I stripped off naked, lay on the top of the bed, and she walked in on the room, and she never walked in my room again.
She was in every hour on the hour.
That was the best thing I ever did, because you could see as I walked out of the house, the curtain would just go back, and she'd see you go down, then she'd go and clean my room. It's fantastic. Oh,
brilliant. That was very innovative of you. I mean, working for that, just quickly, on the cruise ship, I mean, going out of the harbour, was there a lot of French people on that? It must have been pretty high-end cuisine, I'd say.
It was. What was great about Windstar Sales, it was only 150 passengers. So, and there was, people weren't restricted to times or anything like that. You could eat whenever you wanted. And we had two restaurants on board. And we used to pick up fresh products from every port that we stopped in. So, and there was a huge French influence on it because it was a French boat. And but it was absolutely amazing. And like when we went across the Atlantic, they actually took off the stabilizers and the engines and they actually sailed the boat.
Amazing.
I was like, it's stunning, stunning boat.
Well, that was incredible. Miami, Switzerland, I'll tell you. I mean, those were you were having a great time from one place that doesn't sleep at all to another place. Yeah. Just a bit.
But the cruise lines is interesting. Not that I wouldn't recommend anybody to work on them, but it was, you basically work 7 days a week for a long period of time. And your day off was that you didn't have to work breakfast or lunch, but you still had to work dinner.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was amazing when you were actually working on board. I was young and we were just focusing, put your head down and work. But it was, everybody was doing the same. So you didn't really notice till you actually left the boat and you go, my God, what was I doing? What was I even thinking? But it was a great life experience. It was a really good life experience. Learned to mix with so many different types of people from different backgrounds, different countries and just kind of understanding them as people. So I think I learned more about people in that part of my work experience.
Yeah, of course, because I mean, cruising, I mean, you know, I've done a few of them all over the world. You know, you meet people, weird, wonderful. I sailed across from Southampton to New York 8 days, and just the amazing amount of people you actually meet that you'd never think you'd ever see anywhere, all together in one place.
I did it. The Queen Mary asked me to come on as a celebrity chef for a week or whichever cruise I wanted to go and do demos, and that's a massive ship, and that was really interesting. I was behind the scenes in the kitchens there and stuff like that, and it's just like a machine. It's just like the amount of food that they're going through and stuff like that. But that's a tough environment to work in because they're at sea for 8 days and they have to bring on all the food. So
yeah.
a lot of it is actually coming on frozen because they have no choice but to do it that way. But the best crack to be had on those boats is the crew bar.
Yeah, yeah. Or the Red Lion karaoke bar, actually. Yeah. I won't go into that now. Yeah. So your first piece of music this evening, Kevin, is Van Morrison.
Van Morrison, great guy. And I love Van Morrison. I love his whole tone of voice and the way he tells a story through his song.